Are Jacksonville policies slamming the door on affordable housing? Good Thursday morning. We're live from Studio 5 for First Coast Connect on 89.9. And I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for being with us. Just ahead, find out why Jacksonville is ranked as one of the tougher places to find a place to live that you can actually afford. Is this troubling you? Give us a call. Join the conversation, 549-2937. Then later, don't miss our conversation with PBS NewsHour's Judy Woodruff. The broadcast legend is coming to WJCT Studios this weekend for a special appearance. We'll tell you all about it. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, it is getting harder than ever to find an affordable place to live here in Florida. A growing population, stagnant wages, deep federal cuts to the nation's housing program is making this all the more acute. In fact, it's reaching near crisis levels across the U.S. According to a 2017 report by the National Low Income Housing Coalition, there's actually a supply deficit of more than 36,000 affordable housing units in Jacksonville alone. Now, we're talking about working families seeking housing, not people on welfare. These are folks earning between $25,000 to $50,000 a year, young families just starting out, or elderly people that have worked hard their entire lives and just can't find housing they can afford. At the same time, a new study shows Jacksonville is one of the worst offenders nationally when it comes to landlords discriminating against low-income people. What does it all mean? It means it's tough to find housing. And here's the kicker. The partial government shutdown is making all of this even worse. So just how serious is this issue? It caught our eye for sure. So we're going to begin the hour with a closer look as we welcome by phone Ann Ray. She is manager of the Florida Housing Data Clearinghouse at UF's Schimburg Center for Housing Studies. Ann, good to have you on the show.
Good morning.
And here in studio, Shannon Nasworth, Executive Director of Ability Housing in Jacksonville. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers. Have you heard of the best-selling book, The Rent is Too Damn High? Does that apply to your life? How tough has it been for you to find affordable housing in this area? Let us know. Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org, tweets to at Melissa in Jax, and let us know your thoughts on our Facebook page as well. All right, Ann Ray, let's begin with you. Give us the big picture, because you study the rental markets all across Florida. How serious is the situation?
Well, we've really seen a widening gap between the availability of housing that people can afford and the number of people who need affordable housing. So in Jacksonville, for instance, half of renters pay more than 30% of their income for their housing, which is typically what's considered to be affordable. Jacksonville's growing, just like the state of Florida is growing. Post-recession, we've added a lot of households to the state, but the net growth has all been in renters. And that's placed a tremendous pressure on Jacksonville's rental housing supply. So since the year 2000, Duval County's added about 47,000 renter households. So you have, you know, lower income households, households of modest means, competing with some higher income households who are also renting their housing. And other than the types of affordable and subsidized housing developments that we build every year that Shannon's organization does, for instance, what we're really building now in the rental market is luxury housing. So new housing, new rental housing, other than a small amount of subsidized housing, are renting anywhere from $1,200 to $1,800 a month. If you're making $12 an hour, you can't afford that rent.
Sure. If you're making $12 an hour, you're looking for a rent between, I guess, what, $500 to $600 a month? And
yeah,
those types of units are almost impossible to find.
Right. They're either going to be older and possibly substandard, or you do have programs that are available to build new subsidized housing. So if those are approved, if those dollars come to Jacksonville, then you can expand the supply of affordable housing. But, you know, the demand is growing much faster than that supply.
Demand growing faster than the supply. How hard is affordable housing for you out there, First Coast? Call us up at 549-2937 now. Shannon Nasworth, Executive Director of Ability Housing. It's not as though developers haven't done anything to meet this need. For example, in downtown Jacksonville, the company Vestcor has been putting up affordable housing units, multifamily housing in the La Villa area, just west of downtown. They're planning another one that is going to break ground in Brooklyn this year. which is all very good news. These are nice units, and they're affordable under the definition of the law. I don't know how much they are per month, but they're a lot more affordable than everything else that's out there. But all of that said, as Ann just pointed out, the demand far outstrips the supply. And now the partial government shutdown is going into its third week, and that is affecting not only food assistance programs, but also federal low-income housing. How is that impacting low-income housing?
Sure. So the biggest way that it's impacting is a lot of one of the biggest ways we make housing affordable is by preventing by providing rental assistance, the Section 8 vouchers that people have heard of. Well, our local housing authorities are not receiving those funds. So we have people living in apartments that are receiving rent assistance that make the apartments affordable, and those subsidies are not going to be coming in, and they're not going to be able to pay their rent. And that's a crisis.
Will they be kicked out?
Hopefully not. Hopefully the shutdown will end soon. I'm sure that Jacksonville Housing Authority, as Ability Housing is figuring out how to juggle and, you know, tap into their own reserves with the hope of being refunded quickly. But if the shutdown goes on, our reserves will be diminished and we won't have the capital to tap into. And therefore, that's when we really have to start negotiating with landlords and trying to find solutions. If it goes on for an extended period of time, landlords can't go without their rent for a long period of time. They have a business to run. And that will really create problems for us, for the residents, and with the landlords.
And it's 549-2937 to join us. Now, let me ask you, Anne, about another study that we saw. This came from a think tank in D.C. It shows that Jacksonville is actually one of the worst offenders in the country when it comes to providing affordable housing for people receiving federal assistance. It's very tough to get a Section 8 housing, and then when you get it, most people in this city that have it are crammed into basically the worst neighborhoods of the city. Most landlords in more middle-class parts of Jacksonville are frankly discriminating against low-income people. They're not allowing them to rent in many parts of town. Can you share your thoughts about those numbers and how that impacts the situation?
Sure. So what that study showed was that the Federal Housing Voucher Program, commonly known as Section 8, has rent limits for what tenants can, for the units that tenants can rent with their vouchers. And the study looked at, around the country, at the largest metropolitan areas, how much, where people were living, what neighborhoods they were living in, and then also how much housing was available that was affordable at the moderate, not the lowest rents, but the moderate rents that that federal program allows. And what I found is that actually those units that could be affordable are dispersed pretty well throughout Jacksonville. It's not like some cities where the only place that somebody with a voucher could rent is the lowest income neighborhood. So there's a lot of potential housing for people with vouchers, but they found that the vouchers were still concentrated in just a few areas in Jacksonville. And, you know, part of it is that really speaks to the overall shortage of affordable housing and housing units. When you have a lot of housing supply, then tenants have a lot of choices. If housing supply is really constricted, if occupancy rates are very high, then a landlord can say, well, I don't want to deal with the voucher program. You know, they can either, you can say they're discriminating against tenants or that they don't want to deal with the government regulations involved in the program. But when they have their choice of many, many, many tenants, there's a lot less supply available for voucher holders. And that's another reason why expanding the supply of affordable housing is so important. It gives voucher holders a lot more choices, as it gives all tenants a lot more choices.
Here's another nugget about this we just learned about. Our news partner, The Jackson, just reported that even though all over the country, abandoned hotels are being transformed into permanent and affordable housing, that's a big trend apparently around the nation. In Jacksonville, a developer tried to do that. They put forth a proposal to convert an abandoned hotel building near I-95 and University Boulevard into a multifamily residential building with affordable housing units. The city denied the rezoning request.
Yes.
Shannon, they said no.
Yeah, my understanding is the city decided that the location of that particular abandoned hotel was not suitable for residential. I'm not personally familiar with that area, so I don't really know. If the city didn't take into account the income or the composition of the residents and just said housing in general isn't appropriate there, that there's nothing wrong with that. If, however, there was any implication that because it was low income, that was part of the decision, that's when the problems can come in.
Right. According to the Jackson, it's right near a bus line, right near the Butler Boulevard corridor where there are lots of jobs. There was an affordable housing complex very nearby. So it's a head-scratching decision. Ann Ray, since you study this issue, big picture, how do you rate Jacksonville when it comes to getting out in front of this issue, understanding this issue, trying to find solutions to this issue of affordable housing as compared to, you know, other cities?
You know, I think Jacksonville is struggling with the same thing that a lot of cities are struggling with, which is that this crisis, which I think in the past, I mean, we've always had a shortage of affordable housing, particularly for the lowest income workers or for very vulnerable populations like the elderly or people with disabilities. I think Jacksonville is struggling with the same thing that other cities are struggling with, which is now that what used to be sort of mid-priced, moderate-priced cities are becoming too expensive for the residents. How do they expand their affordable housing supply? Jacksonville used, for a while, had a relatively soft rental housing market, and we've seen occupancy rates shoot way up. So it shows that there's a gap between the supply and demand. I'm not sure I'm in a position to evaluate how the city's efforts compare to others, but I know a lot of cities around the country, and certainly in the state of Florida, are struggling to figure out, you know, how do they get the business community involved in promoting affordable housing, both for their own employees and for the community in general? How does philanthropy get involved and support affordable housing? And I think local governments are starting to realize that with a federal pullback in affordable housing, they can't necessarily depend on the outside to expand their supply of affordable housing. So more and more cities are starting to think about how they can raise their own funds for housing.
Sure. And as I said a few minutes ago, it's not as though nobody's playing in this space at all. There are affordable housing units going up downtown. Several of them have already opened or are going to be opening. So we want your calls right now. Is rent tough for you? Do you struggle finding affordable housing? When we're mainly talking about the rental market, of course, the real estate buyer's market is a whole other kettle of fish, but you can give us a call about that too. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Jennifer is in Arlington. Hey, Jennifer, good morning.
Good morning. Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
She answered my question, which was, you know, what's the issue with, you know, why are we, Jacksonville is growing, but why is it that we keep on getting all these luxury homes versus more affordable homes? Like, I work a full-time job, and so does my fiance. We shouldn't have to struggle finding affordable homes. But it seems like every time we went looking for an apartment, a one-bedroom apartment would be, you know, over $1,000. And, you know, that wasn't the case, you know, 5 years ago when we got together. 5 years ago when we got together, we thought we don't need to buy a house because, you know, we're comfortable renting. We, you know, we have all the amenities we need. So we liked renting more than we, you know, we wanted to purchase a home. And 5 years ago, for us, it was very comfortable. We had a two-bedroom apartment for $900. And then after that, it was like it just kept on going up. I mean, we moved to an apartment on Gate Parkway. From 1 year to the next, our rent went a whole $100. So we went from paying $1,500 to paying $1,600. And I said, this is it. We can't afford that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
It's like Jacksonville, it's growing. And sure, we're getting, the town center is huge. I mean, we're getting so many, you know, the Topgolf. I mean, we're getting so many things. But we are not a tourist town where we're getting all that revenue either. We don't have people who make, you know, that type of income to pay an apartment for $1,200.
And now you're up, you said, now you're up to $1,600. What are you going to do, Jennifer?
No, we ended up moving, actually. We had to, you know, instead at that point when our rent was going up to $1,600, we ended up moving to a one-bedroom apartment in the Arlington area, very small, very out of date. So we're uncomfortable. We're very, very, like, we downsize a whole lot.
Okay. And I'm sorry to hear that. I'm going to get a few more calls, Jennifer, but thank you for sharing your story with us. Thanks for that. That's Jennifer on the South Side, or Jennifer in Arlington, rather. She was on the South Side. Now she's in Arlington because of this. Ray is on the South Side. Hi, Ray. Go ahead. What's up with you?
Good morning. Hey, good morning. I got to take the side of the landlords a little bit on this. I used to own single family residences and tried renting them to the lower income people. It was out on the West Side, and I just gave up because the simple fact of the matter is you're not making that much money on the property, and the tenants don't take care of the stuff. I mean, I had ridiculous issues with people, skipping out on the rent, even stealing the toilet seat in the mailbox when they left, that kind of foolishness. So it really tends to discourage you from owning property and making it available moderate income. You know, when you charge more, you do get a class of people essentially who are more interested in taking care of the place where they live.
So it's really good to get your point of view as a landlord, Ray. Knowing what you know about it from the business side, what do you think is a way to try to address this in Jacksonville?
If you're going to do the Section 8 thing, you're going to give a voucher, then there needs to be some method of, accountability for, seeing to it that damages are going to be covered and, those sorts of things. I mean, I don't know how you can teach people to be more personally responsible.
Okay,
but I
appreciate the call and you sharing your perspective on this. So Shannon Nasworth, there you have a former landlord saying, I'm just not going to get into this market because of these issues. And this goes a long way toward explaining why Section 8 people in Jacksonville are crammed into the worst neighborhoods of the city. Landlords don't want to rent to them. So how do we get through this issue?
Well, I think there's a myriad of things that it's a complex issue that's going to unfortunately have complex solutions. And it's unfortunately had those experiences. I'm a landlord as well, renting to over 500 households a year. We haven't had those types of problems. And most of our residents earn less than $10,000 a year. So unfortunately, there is a reputation. And when one person does something wrong, unfortunately, it tarnishes everyone else in the same category. And that is one of the barriers. Another barrier is sometimes dealing with the Section 8 voucher is just a paperwork headache. If you can make money not dealing with it, why would you want to deal with it? That's just a common sense. Their mission is to make money because they're for-profit landlords. There's nothing wrong with that. Do it as easily as you can. In the end, what we're going to need to do is invest in more affordable housing. We have an 80-unit property under construction right now on the West Side. As you mentioned, Vestcor has several properties that have just opened or are under construction. But that's not going to get it done. That's a total of under 1,000 units. And we need thousands and thousands of affordable units in this community.
And Ann Ray, way back in the 90s, the state legislature passed an Affordable Housing Act to try to generate revenue for a housing trust fund to make this easier for landlords. But that money's never been used properly. Isn't that right?
Well, over the past several years, different amounts of the Affordable Housing Trust Fund have been swept by the legislature into general revenue. I think the total is up to about $2 billion over the life of the program that should have been going to affordable housing programs, that instead were used for other legislative priorities or for general revenue. So that money some of that money would be going directly to local governments. So the city of Jacksonville would be receiving money for a host of different affordable housing programs, ranging from affordable home ownership to homelessness prevention to building more affordable rental housing. Some of it would also be going to the state to allocate for the types of projects that Vestcor and Ability Housing do to make units more affordable. So certainly one solution is to keep the money that's supposed to be used for affordable housing that our state is raising.
And if you're just tuning in
affordable housing.
Okay. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about new data about affordable housing in Florida and Jacksonville. How tough is finding a place to live for you? It's 549-2937. Angela is also in Arlington. Hey, Angela, how are you this morning?
Hey, and how are you, Melissa?
Real
great,
good.
Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I've been in the Arlington area for about 3 years now. We pay what I think is a great price for the house, but that's also why we haven't been able to move out. Originally, we planned on staying there for 6 months, and it's been 3 years, and we can't move out because we can't find anything that's affordable. Our house is older. It isn't very efficient, so that kind of affects it a little bit. But
and are you renting it, or are you renting the house?
Yes, we're renting the house. And
how much?
We're paying $1,100 right now.
Okay.
And we've been there for the 3 years. It's gone up $100, but in 3 years, I don't think that's too unreasonable.
How many bedrooms?
So we're in a 3-bedroom, and it has an extra den and a small pool, which
nice.
Is in ground. And like I said, for $1,100 in Jacksonville, that's amazing. But
sure.
That being said, it also has horrible floors. It's really inefficient with the air and the heating, you know, light.
Yeah.
And I believe that we're starting to have some issues with some mold.
So oh, no. So you'd like to move. It sounds like you'd like to move, but you just can't find an affordable rent in a better neighborhood. Is that right?
Yep. For what we pay, I would be moving into a 1-bedroom apartment, and I can't do that for, you know, I have a child. And
yeah, I gotcha. Yeah, that's the thing. And Angela, thank you so much. Her story is so common, Shannon.
It absolutely is. And I think one of the issues that she's talking about also, one of the pressures on the rental market is we're not building first-time homebuyer homes anymore. So there are more people who would like to leave the rental market, but they can't enter home ownership, which is just creating more and more of a bottleneck. It is one of the reasons, one of myriad of reasons why we're having such a crunch.
And first-time buyer homes, what my parents' generation called a starter home.
Exactly.
Those don't really exist anymore.
They don't build them anymore.
Why?
Because you can make more money on bigger homes. You know, again, if somebody's in the business to make money building homes, they can make more money building one large home than building 20 small homes.
Shelley is in Orange Park. Hey, Shelley, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, just to build on what your guest said, the pressure on the first-time homeowner market. I just wonder if anybody looked at the issue that during the housing crisis that we had in here in Florida, that companies were buying up all those homes, and they're consolidated under buyer companies. We had family members who were just married trying to buy a starter home, and they were outbid repeatedly by companies that were buying them up. And even just this past month, our daughter and son-in-law were trying to sell their starter home to move into a bigger home. This is one that they owned. And again, a company coming in and outbidding people, regular couples who were trying to buy a starter home.
Mm.
And yeah.
Wow,
so
yeah.
I don't know if anybody's in that, but I think that's putting a lot of pressure on and turning that into a rental, and of course it's all consolidated, so the rental prices have just been just going skyrocketing, and then no starter homes left for people to buy.
Wow, yeah, thanks for that, Shelley. Important points from her. And let's go now to Leon on the south side. Hey, Leon, go ahead.
I just wanted to make a comment. I did real estate for many, many years, and the thing about real estate is it is slow to adjust. People respond to the economy in general, the stock market, and they look at it going up and down, and very it responds very quickly because it's easily traded and easily utilized. Real estate takes a long time to absorb. The homes that a lot of these new condos and new homes are being built are hitting the upscale market. As the people move out of the older units into those units, those that are successful and able to do so, the units that are older that have been rehabbed are actually going to become more affordable. So, but you have to keep in mind, real estate is it's the turtle in the free market economy.
I think that's an excellent point, Leon. Thank you so much for sharing the benefit of your experience. And Anne Ray, let me hit you with some comments coming into the show from all over the place. Roselle writes the show, please explain the difference between affordable and low-income housing. Here's a tweet. Is the problem the cost of housing, or is it our low and stagnant wages? And here's a comment on our Facebook page from Susan. Should zoning require developers to offer affordable housing? Discuss solutions. Another idea would be that every school district should have a variety of housing within its district. Okay, so in the short time we have before the break, Anne Ray, if you could address those, beginning with the idea that perhaps wages aren't catching up to skyrocketing housing prices.
Sure, there's a gap, and it's growing. I mean, certainly I would say from the housing boom on, the growth in housing prices has become completely unhinged from whatever growth we've had in wages. People expect to pay a lot more for their housing as a percentage of their income than they used to. People are buying homes with their wages that I don't think they would have considered doing a decade or two ago. So that gap is certainly growing. To give you an idea, though, to afford a typical two-bedroom apartment in the Jacksonville area, somebody, an individual, would have to earn about $18,000 $18 an hour. So about $36,000 a year. We have a lot of jobs that pay less than that. And so while wage growth, of course, is really important and it will help people keep up, even the $15 an hour minimum wage would not be enough to afford a typical two-bedroom in Jacksonville.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to look at both ends. You need to look at both how you bring housing costs down and how you bring wages up.
And quickly, Shannon Nasworth, how you zone areas, the policy piece.
Absolutely. I mean, there is such things as inclusionary zoning. There are also even simpler things like allowing accessory dwelling units, the old-fashioned apartment above the garage. We don't allow that in most zoning districts. That creates affordable housing both for the person renting the apartment and the person owning the home. There are lots of different ways we can make it easier to build smaller homes. We not require such large lots, not require such setbacks. Look at our parking requirements, which make it very expensive for every multifamily. There are low-hanging fruit that can be done on the zoning front that will help with a problem. In the end, we need to invest in the housing. The easiest is to tell our state legislature to stop stealing the affordable housing funds and to use them for their intended purpose. That will help. But locally, we're also going to have to figure out how we're going to make these investments.
Thank you both so much for sharing your insights. Anne Ray, UF's Schimberg Center for Housing Studies, Shannon Nasworth, President, CEO of Ability Housing. Thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And still to come, network legend Judy Woodruff. She's coming to town this weekend. We'll have a conversation about her career covering presidents and politics in just a moment. Stay with us.
What are faith communities doing to help with the challenges of food insecurity? How prevalent are these problems in Northeast Florida?
I'm Kyle Reese.
And I'm Nancy Bronner. What role does food play in faith traditions? What does faith say about those who go to bed hungry at night? Faith and food, that's Faith Matters, Monday afternoon at 1 here on WJCT.
We hope you'll join us.
Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. President Trump.
Welcome back. Well, she's been a presence on network television now for four decades. Judy Woodruff, anchor and editor of the PBS NewsHour, is coming to WJCT studios this weekend to give a talk celebrating the success of women in the midterm elections. I spoke with Judy about her career covering presidents and politics, the Me Too movement, and more. Take a listen. Judy Woodruff, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show in advance of your appearance here in Jacksonville at WJCT Studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
I am delighted to talk with you, Melissa. I'm really looking forward to being back in Jacksonville.
Lots of excitement about your talk coming to address women who have been working for some time to get more local and regional women elected to public office. Now, let me ask you, we'll talk about that in a moment, but with everything you've been covering lately on PBS NewsHour, it's interesting to note that you have covered every presidency, every administration since the Carter administration. You've interviewed a lot of presidents and heads of state, and so I guess I need to begin by asking you what it's been like for you the last 2 years covering the Trump presidency.
Well, it's been different.
I bet.
It's I've covered, you're right, I've covered Democrats and Republicans going all the way back to Jimmy Carter. I first came to Washington with NBC News to cover the Carter presidency, and then it was on to Reagan and Bush, and the rest is history. And I've covered everyone since then for NBC and PBS and CNN. Now I'm back, of course, at PBS. The difference about Donald Trump is he's the first president who didn't come to office with any sort of political background, and he's basically taken the presidency and shaped it in his own image and in his own interests. And it's been a change. And all of us who cover the city, who cover the country, try to cover American politics and government, have had to adjust to that.
What have been the biggest changes for someone that's a longtime Washington resident, a longtime prominent member of this world? What have been the biggest adjustments?
Well, I would say the biggest change for us and the biggest adjustment is getting used to a president who uses the bully pulpit of the White House. He uses the megaphone of the White House in a very different way. He's a master at social media, using Twitter and television and radio to get his message across and to communicating with voters directly that way. As you know, he's got 50 or 60 million people following him on Twitter. He communicates regularly that way. President Obama used Twitter, but not nearly as often, as frequently as President Trump does. And you add to that the fact that President Trump is a larger-than-life personality with very distinct views, somebody who doesn't come out of the political establishment, and who communicates so differently. We've all had to make a big adjustment. I'll tell you one thing in terms of the daily work schedule. We used to think in terms of you'd go home at night and there wouldn't be that much news, but nowadays the news is going flat out from the time you wake up in the morning until you close your eyes at night.
Yeah, certainly. And let me ask you as well, everything that's been happening over the last several days, and also the president's address to the nation from the Oval Office, lots of discussion about whether President Trump will declare a national emergency over what he says is a crisis at the southern border. Do you anticipate that happening? And if so, what are the political and legal ramifications of that?
Well, the president's being pretty coy about that right now. He's been dropping hints that he might do that. And, in fact, I was at the White House yesterday for an off-the-record session with top-level officials. That's all I can say. But what I can tell you is that he's leaving it as a big hint, but not committing to do it. I think he thinks of it as a bargaining tool. Perhaps he thinks if he drops that out there that maybe Democrats will be more inclined to compromise, to go along. We have not seen any evidence, though, of that so far. I don't rule it out. I think it could happen. I think it is. I think the experts are saying it is possible for the president to try to do it. He could certainly try it, but there's no question it would be challenged in the courts. And it's really impossible to say what the courts would do. But I think right now my sense is that if he were going to do it, he would have done it by now. But I certainly don't totally rule it out.
Going beyond the Trump administration, you know, I have to tell you on a personal note that you've always been a role model for me. I made the decision pretty early in my teen years that I wanted to go into journalism. And when I was in high school and just starting to think about that as a career, you were one of the only women on network news at the time. There weren't a lot of them. And you had been a national figure, as I said, since I want to say the late 70s into the early 80s. The business has changed so much for women. You've been an advocate for women in media and also women in leadership positions. And that's why you're coming to Jacksonville to talk about that. The Me Too and the Time's Up movements have transformed the workplace, including media organizations. And so with the benefit of your experience and things that you've gone through, I'd just be curious to get your thoughts about where you see these issues going this year and beyond? You know, CBS News, for example, just appointed a woman as president. So that garnered a lot of headlines. What are your thoughts about all of that?
Well, there's so many things to celebrate with regard to women. As you mentioned, Susan Zirinsky, first woman named to head CBS News, that really storied news organization that it is, going way back to the days of Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite, and a place where women have been given significant roles. I mean, I guess Connie Chung was an anchor on the CBS, a co-anchor of this CBS Evening News for a time back in the 1990s, I think it was. You certainly have women in prominent roles on the air at CBS, but you haven't had a woman at the very top. In fact, none of the broadcast networks, if I'm remembering this correctly, have yet had a woman CEO. But that has been changing. CNN has had a woman chief, not now, but in the past. I'm so happy to say that PBS, we're way ahead of the curve. The head of PBS is a woman, Paula Kerger. The head of the station that presents the NewsHour, WETA, which is the Washington educational TV station, is headed by a woman, Sharon Rockefeller. The NewsHour's executive producer is a woman, Sarah Just. And, of course, I'm the anchor of the program and the managing editor. So we have a woman-heavy shop here at PBS, and we're very proud of that. But across the board, I would say there's a lot to celebrate, but we still have a lot of work to do. I mean, women have come a long way. Women are taking on more and more on-air positions and management leadership roles, but not enough. There still aren't enough of it. It's still remarkable when a woman is named to head a news division, or when a woman is named to another position. We still make a big fuss over it because it's unusual, and we need more women in these management decision making jobs. You need women making the call when as to what stories are going to be covered, who's going to be hired, who's going to get what assignment. Those are all important decisions that are career changing. And we need women in those roles, and that's why I celebrate Susan Zirinsky at CBS News. It's why I celebrate, you know, what we've got going here at PBS and at the NewsHour. So, the glass is clearly half full. It's not as empty as it was when I started out, or almost empty. But we still have a lot of work to do, and the Me Too movement tells you a lot about that.
Oh, sure. Do you have any Me Too stories from your earlier career? I'm sure you do. Every woman I know does.
Yeah, I think every woman I know certainly has experienced something in one way or another, where they were either put in an uncomfortable situation or worse, or where they were either directly harassed or put in such an uncomfortable position that they ended up having to leave or give up on a career. There are now so many stories. I'm on the board of a group that is dedicated, Press Forward, that is dedicated to supporting women in the news media across the board, and frankly, teaching them, giving them the tools to stand up to colleagues, bosses, people they work with who, for whatever reason, may take advantage of the situation because they're a woman. So, we're opening our eyes to something that's been there for a long time, but it's well overdue, and we still have a lot of work to go. There have been some big names in our industry who've been outed and who've lost their jobs. We've been stunned by the loss of people like, or the firing of people like Charlie Rose and Matt Lauer and so many others. But we have to stay vigilant.
And this is just a short window into the talk you'll be giving. When you visit Jacksonville this weekend to meet with women, they've been called the 9 in 15 organization, working to get more women on the Jacksonville City Council in the year 2015. But the organization has sort of moved beyond that goal now, 3 years on. So it's such a pleasure to speak with you, and I look forward to seeing you here this weekend in sunny Florida. So, Judy Woodruff, thanks so much for giving us a few minutes of your time.
Thank you. I was there in 2013 as they were kicking off that effort, and I'm really happy to be coming back.
Thanks again.
That's Judy Woodruff headlining a tribute to women in politics Saturday, 9:30 a.m. here at WJCT Studios. You can come. Just go to Eventbrite and search Judy Woodruff, a tribute to women in politics. Well, we want to take a minute to tell you about a unique opportunity for women to build a career in the culinary industry. Chef Chris Brown of 927 Events is cooking up something new in town. It's called the Empowered Kitchen. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Melissa.
Good to see you. What is the Empowered Kitchen?
The Empowered Kitchen is a nonprofit that I decided to start because of several disparities within the food community and the opportunities, which I think boil down to educational opportunities in different aspects, and it all goes right hand in hand with food deserts and locations in our town and educational opportunities.
Right. Lots of food deserts, lots of women struggling to make a good living, and lots of women in the restaurant and culinary industry.
A lot.
You want to empower them. How are you going to do that?
Well, we're going to offer mentoring. We have some amazing people on our board of directors, and we're going to offer programs to mentor them, everything from the financial aspects to the marketing to website design to food costs and menu development. And whether they want to be in, say, a Riverside art market in a tent selling their product, or whether they want to be in a food truck, or whether they want to be in a brick and mortar.
You're going to give them the tools they need
to
become more successful.
Yes.
How can people apply and be part of this?
The application process is on our website. It's pretty extensive. And then we will interview and try to pick the best candidates that can move forward through the program.
Okay. This is just starting, by the way. So
it's brand new.
Yeah, this is brand new. You're getting the early word on the Empowered Kitchen.
Yeah, this is the first word.
This is exciting. This is open to women in the culinary field, a new nonprofit helping you grow your business, whether it's a restaurant, a food truck, a food product. Lots of ways that you can get involved in this and become more successful. And I can't think of anyone better than you, Chris Brown, to be teaching people about this.
Thank you. This makes
total sense. So if you're just hearing about this, just go to their website right now and find out more. It's theempoweredkitchen.org, theempoweredkitchen.org, a new food incubator. It's training, empowerment, mentoring to local women entrepreneurs who want to build and grow their culinary business, just like Chris has done. One of the best chefs and caterers in town, has an amazing food truck of her own. She even created a food truck court. She's done so much in this business. So, Chris, you know what I think about you. This is an amazing thing. Go to theempoweredkitchen.org and find out more. Thanks so much for stopping by. We hope you'll come back soon as this gets going.
We will.
All right. And in a moment, our top five things to do this weekend. That's next.
The great state of Ohio raised its minimum wage January the 1st, indexing, it's called.
I think the minimum wage is going to keep on increasing, and we should try to keep it up with, you know, the cost of living.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, raising wages, rising costs. Next time on Marketplace. Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Janet Napolitano understands the U.S.-Mexico border. Before leading Homeland Security under President Obama, she was governor of Arizona. She even built a wall. But she says border security takes more than that. Next time on The World, Janet Napolitano weighs in on President Trump's wall, on immigration, and on how to make America safe. A long view on Homeland Security on The World. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, my guest will be Kevin Hart, whose stand-up comedy sells out stadiums. He stars with Bryan Cranston in the new movie The Upside. Last month, Hart stepped down from hosting this year's Oscars after facing criticism for earlier homophobic jokes and tweets. The story is still developing. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Most of America's asylum seekers and undocumented immigrants come from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. These countries are fighting poverty, corruption, and crime, problems that many believe the U.S. helped create. Now the U.S. and Mexico plan to spend billions on a kind of Marshall Plan for Central America. Will it work? And if so, how? Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, are you wondering what to do this weekend? Guess what? Right now, we've got a little something new to help you decide. It's the final countdown. The final countdown. Yes, Carrie Speckman, a.k.a. The Spectator, is here. And brand new for 2019, she's going to count down top five events on the First Coast this weekend. Okay, this week marks your fifth anniversary on the show.
As of yesterday. So yesterday was my fifth anniversary.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
Sure. So we thought it was appropriate then to honor that by looking at your top five things to do this weekend, beginning with number five.
But not counting napping.
Not counting napping.
Happy hour.
Yes.
And
getting your
things.
Hair dyed pink. Okay. Yes. Begin with number five. On Sunday, it's the legacy celebration of the beach lady, Mavini Ocean.
Yes, it is. She, of course, fought for American Beach to be preserved.
Up in Fernandina.
In Fernandina. And she, basically spent her whole life doing that. And so it's going to be a celebration on the beach. And then they're also doing stuff with music, and they're showing a documentary called The Beach Lady.
This was about the area's only African-American beach, American Beach up on Amelia Island. So that's coming up Sunday. Number four, the Progressive Comedy Tour with Graham Elwood.
I love me some Graham Elwood. He is a headliner, and he's touring with another guy, and it's not just all political stuff, but it's comedy, and they're going to talk about some political issues. They're also going to have information about grassroots organizations, how you can get involved. So, and it's at Nighthawks.
This is at Nighthawks in Riverside.
In Riverside. That
Saturday night.
That is correct.
All right. That'll be a good show with Graham Elwood. Number three.
Dun, 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 dun. I feel like there should be a drum.
I know.
Every
we need
time.
Another sound effect, don't we? Saturday, it's the Vernardo's Circus, a one ring circus.
The little circus that could.
That's right.
What they call themselves. One ring, but it's created by a former Ringling Brothers. What are they called? Ringmaster.
Ringmaster,
yeah,
sure.
That makes sense.
Kevin Vernardos is his name. And the thing about Vernardos is there are no animals.
Nope.
It's all human performers.
It is performers procured from some of the largest stages around the world.
This is Saturday at the St. Augustine Amphitheater, the Vernardo Circus. Number two, it's tonight. Whose line is it anyway at the Florida Theater? Very cool.
Live.
It's live.
And Greg Proops will be there. Jeff B. Davis, Joel Murray, and we are lucky we're getting Drew Carey.
Drew Carey.
He's not doing everybody's every town show.
Drew Carey coming to town. This is the Emmy-nominated TV beloved classic, Whose Line Is It Anyway? Improvised comedy and songs. The whole thing with this is audience participation.
And you could get pulled up on stage. So
yeah, if you go tonight, you're getting up there with Drew Carey.
Yeah, be ready.
Okay, so I hope tickets still available to that show. It's tonight at the Florida Theater. Okay, and now we are at number one. Spectators' number one pick. What is it?
It is Rock of Ages. It is an epic cruise. It follows Hollywood legends and dreamers in an epic crusade to save the Bourbon Room from demolition. Really, it's like a tribute to the 80s.
This is the Broadway show based on
Tony
the film.
Tony nominated.
Yeah, this was the movie that starred Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
So it's full of 80s music.
Twisted Sister, Sticks,
yeah,
Poison,
Journey, you name it.
Also, coincidentally, The Final Countdown.
Is in the film.
Is in the movie.
Okay,
isn't that crazy?
So that's Carey's number one. Rock of Ages coming back, by the way. I think this isn't the first time
I've seen it at the Times Union Center. I saw it before, yes.
Yeah, the Tony-nominated Rock of Ages tonight at the Times Union Center. If you love the 80s, this is your number one. I know
it's
your number
one. It was so hard to not sing, like, the entire time. But there were people behind me singing, too.
Oh, I bet. Okay, well, go to thespectator.com. For more information about her top five for the week, and always good to see you.
Always a pleasure, ma'am. Haven't seen you since last year. Actually, that's not true.
And you just had a birthday, so happy birthday as well. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us. All right, and that is our show. Thanks so much for listening. Michelle Quorum is our director. Heather Schatz is our producer. And if you missed anything this morning, catch our rebroadcast of First Coast Connect tonight at 8 o'clock. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.